From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. TV critic Peter J. Boyer has written a new book that asks the question, who killed CBS News? On today's edition of Fresh Air, we find out Boyer's answer. Also today, I speak with Susan Bauer. She's written about people in pain, with nausea, headaches, and just about every other symptom you or they can imagine. Her subject is hypochondria. America's most celebrated songwriter, Irving Berlin, is entering his second century. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of Berlin's songs performed by Elizabeth Welch. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the congressional push to make English our official language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In the CBS legend, Edward R. Murrow and his team invented broadcast journalism. TV critic Peter J. Boyer says that legend is not far from the truth, but in the last few years, the network has rejected the styles and philosophies that made the outstanding reputation of CBS News. Boyer describes CBS News as a broken-hearted and defeated institution. He explains how it got that way in his new book, Who Killed CBS? The Undoing of America's Number One News Network. Boyer is the television correspondent for the New York Times and a former national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He served as television critic for National Public Radio's Morning Edition and as media critic for the CBS Morning News. Peter J. Boyer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Let's take the vital signs of CBS News first and see how dead it is in your terms. I mean, what are the signs of it not being what it once was?
Well, I suppose you could consider the question on two planes. I mean, there still is, of course, a CBS News, and there still is a building with CBS News printed on the side of it. The CBS News that interested me, the CBS News that was worth writing about, let's put it that way, that in fact gave the place its worth, was the CBS News that specialized in journalism, that really did set the standard in broadcasting for journalism. The CBS News that was better than it ever had to be, the CBS News of Murrow and Severide and Collingwood and those guys in the radio days, and in the Cronkite, through the Cronkite era and the television time, that CBS News was quite consciously altered, ultimately from a corporate mandate to turn the institution, turn CBS News into a profit center. And it was a very conscious decision that ultimately brought the place to grief. I mean, it brought the place to grief principally because the people inside CBS News continued to think of themselves as the heirs to Murrow and Cronkite, while the people on top at CBS News did not.
Why is the death of CBS News, or its alleged death, of significance to viewers? Why is it important to people who don't work there?
For this reason. You have to first accept the premise that CBS News is an important institution, and I will make that case happily. For one thing, the airwaves belong to you and me and to your listeners. I mean, the Communications Act, they are obliged to set one tiny corner of their enterprise, CBS the corporation, aside for public service, and the way they had done it best was in news. CBS News, beyond that, was, and to some degree remains, a public trust, I think. It was CBS News and Murrow, in See It Now, in the emerging television age, that in fact probably turned the tide of opinion in the McCarthy era. Sure, there had been a lot of reporting about it. In fact, Murrow was probably late on the McCarthy issue. But when he confronted McCarthy and the issue of McCarthyism in that See It Now in the mid-50s, it turned the tide of opinion. Walter Cronkite, Halberstam and other print reporters had been telling the story of Vietnam for years before Cronkite finally decides to get out of his anchor chair and go there for 6 days. But once he went there for 6 days, returns and tells the world that maybe the Vietnam War isn't winnable and that we should withdraw with honor, instantly, as Lyndon Johnson and any of his men will tell you, that issue was decided. A Cronkite show again in Watergate. He turned over two nights to special Watergate reports. That is said to have turned the tide of public opinion in Watergate. CBS News was the place of defense of the United States, of the selling of the Pentagon, of harvest of shame. It was a place that sought to uplift and inform first. And if we can also get ratings, well, that's nice. That is important to viewers. The fact that 12 years ago, fully 80% of the best documentary, working documentary makers in this country worked at CBS News, and today that staff is down to one, means something to viewers in this country.
TV critic Peter J. Boyer is my guest. We're discussing the subject of his new book, Who Killed CBS? Let's talk first about some of the background that led to the changes in philosophy at the news department at CBS.
Yes.
First of all, tell me if I'm right here. CBS used to be the number one network, and now it's number three?
Yes. Their problems are not limited to news. They were the number one, this year. 3 weeks ago, they finished in last place for the first time since there has been a CBS. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking of the primetime entertainment ratings.
So part of what happened here, you describe in your book how CBS had really had primacy, you know, in the ratings. Then ABC started making this run for the affiliates,
right,
and tried to get affiliates to defect from CBS and NBC to ABC.
Right.
And then the whole balance of power started to shift.
What happened? There were large forces at work here, some of them actually quite grand, historically speaking. I mean, we're talking about generation. And my story is a very particular story showing how these forces played out in what, in fact, was a very insular, very finite, very easy to pry apart and look at institution, CBS News. But the forces that were taking place, we are now in the coming of age of the Vietnam generation, the post-Cronkite generation, if you will. Walter and his generation inside CBS were moving aside. On the corporate end of it, Mr. Paley, Bill Paley, who founded the company and who had set aside CBS News into a gilded cage, as it was called, he was stepping aside and being replaced by a corporate management. People who went to business school and believed in setting up economics models that said, well, broadcasting is our maturing money cow. We've got to milk it for all the cash we can get to pay for the new businesses that will ultimately replace it. They were the people who in the late 70s, beginning 1980-81, looked at CBS News, and they had no special feel for it. They hadn't invented the place. They hadn't decreed, as had Paley, there will be news. They looked at it and saw another division, like records or stations or anything else, and they asked the question, why can't CBS News operate at a profit? And they put into place people, including the very colorful character, perhaps the central character of my book, Van Gordon Sauter. They put into place managers at the news division that would carry out this new vision. And the vision was, let's make news programs that can get ratings, that can get the broadest possible audience. In other words, let's be television first and journalists second. And that's standing the CBS legacy on its head, and the place just came apart from inside after that.
Well, it's almost amazing looking back now that things had ever been otherwise.
News
was allowed to operate without worrying about
the
profit or
ratings.
I mean,
it is the unlikeliest thing. In a way, I suppose we should be counting our blessings that there ever was a CBS News. It is quite unlikely in the television age. I mean, television is a wonderfully seductive medium. The visual imperative is so compelling on television. How in the world did anybody ever get away with putting black and white migrant farm workers, for goodness sakes, on television when you can put a talking horse named Mr. Ed on? Well, in fact, Ed Murrow did put that on, and in fact, it made a big difference in this country, at least in the minds of a lot of viewers. It was an unlikely confluence of events that caused CBS News to be great, and it was a much more rational, understandable series of events that undid CBS News.
A more empirical,
yes,
measurable series. So Van Gorder Sorter becomes the new president of CBS News with this understanding that news should like go to work for the network, make ratings, make money. What were some of the first changes he made to the news division, to what we'd see on television?
Well, the very first change he made was a series of personnel changes. His first instruction was to make Dan Rather work. I don't mean literally go to work. I mean to make him succeed, work.
This
work
was shortly after
terms.
He had replaced Cronkite.
That's right. In fact, the fact that Rather was failing so unhappily and so miserably as Walter's replacement in the ratings prompted the early arrival of a Van Gordon Sauter. And what he did was remake the institution in Dan Rather's image. He got rid of all of Walter's people. He just literally almost threw them out the door. They ended up, dispersed throughout the CBS News empire. He brought in people who understood the message, Dan is God in this place. Dan has to be comfortable to look well on television, and to make him comfortable, we all have to be on his team, which is how Dan came to have more power at CBS News than any anchor ever had or probably should have, which, of course, led to its own series of difficulties later on. I mean, not least among them, the fact that Walter Cronkite himself, who was being paid $1 million a year as a special correspondent for CBS News, wasn't allowed on the CBS News air.
Now, what was the rationale behind not allowing him on the air with Rather?
To quote Van Sauter, almost precisely, Walter made Dan nervous. Having Walter around sent, in their minds, dual messages to both insiders and the viewers, who, you know, it occurred to them, I suppose in their mind's eye, if there is such a thing as a corporate mind's eye, imagine a television screen with Dan Rather and Walter sharing it, basically. Where are viewers' eyeballs going to go? They're going to go to Uncle Walter. And in fact, of course, to this day, Walter can walk into a room and get the attention of a Hollywood star. I think that was what was on their minds. I know that that was what was on the mind of Van Gordon Sauter when he decreed that, essentially, that Walter wouldn't have a role in the new CBS News, which leads you to the unbelievable circumstance of election night 1984, Walter Cronkite, sat alone in his apartment watching the election results in his pajamas in Manhattan.
You mentioned the amount of power that was given to Dan Rather. One of the things he did was draw up an A-list of reporters, of the reporters he thought were the best, and they weren't allowed to report
That's
for
right.
other programs.
Imagine in a place where people believe they are they believe their own publicity, that we're the New York Times of broadcasting, that ours is the broadcast of record. People who knew themselves to be the best. Imagine the effect of suddenly walking down the hallway one day and realizing that you're not on something called, that an A-list has been drawn up and you're not on it. You wear glasses, you are thick of build, as was Ike Pappas. You know, Ike Pappas had been on how many tours of Vietnam, had eggs thrown at him in riots in Skokie, Illinois, just because he was holding a CBS camera, for God's sakes. You're from CBS, bam, you know, people throwing things at him. Imagine now being told that you can't get on the air just because you're a thick Greek immigrant. Imagine being Marlene Sanders, a great correspondent, a former vice president of documentaries, never getting your phone calls returned, never getting your story ideas considered. Why? Because she was in her 50s and was less cosmetically appealing. She wasn't an A-lister. Well, these things probably aren't worth moral judgment from the outside, and it's maybe only interesting, you know, to insiders by themselves. But what they did was create just a complete division of will inside the place, and it turned the place upon itself because they felt so strongly about themselves as journalists, and suddenly there is this division. It caused them to fall apart when the other things from the outside started happening, Ted Turner and Boesky and all of that.
One other thing I want to get to, during the reign of Van Gordon Sauter at CBS News, one of his most infamous decisions was putting in Phyllis George as the anchor
yes.
of, was it still called the CBS Morning News
yes,
then?
Yes, it was.
And I guess in a lot of ways that kind of epitomized the kind of unholy marriage of show business and news.
That's right. I mean, it is the perfect example of just short-term management and in a way an example of corruption of values. And I mean, Phyllis George, who had never been a journalist, was suddenly the wealthiest journalist, woman journalist at CBS, and an anchor on the preeminent news network at $1 million a year, the day before she hadn't even been in journalism.
So all of this was coming from the top, basically, from management.
Yes,
on
it was coming from the top, but there was complicity from within. Dan Rather, for example, who genuinely comes from that legacy of Murrow and Cronkite and Collingwood and those people. I mean, Dan Rather, one of the best television reporters who ever lived, turned his back just for a moment, he thought, on that, because he needed to succeed more than anything else. Suddenly he has a new manager, a big bearded, pipe-smoking, irreverent, profane former newspaper man named Van Gordon Sauter, who was putting his arm around Dan and massaging Dan and taking care of Dan, and who was throwing the guys out of the building who were hanging around and bad-mouthing Dan. Suddenly this guy says to him, Dan, let's put you in a sweater. Dan, and it's easy, you can understand in retrospect why Rather was willing to go along with all that, why he didn't play the heir to Murrow when some of this was going on at first. Ultimately, of course, he came to take that posture.
Are we talking about anything different at CBS, different from what happens at the other networks? I mean, for instance, on the morning news, you had David Hartman on ABC. Now, he was kind of a washed-up actor at the time that he accepted that position.
That's right. that's in fact directly and exactly put. Yes, it is something different, and in a way, the question answers the question. The fact that you don't hear much about it at ABC tells you something. It is as if the New York Times tomorrow not only went to a full-color front page, which would raise eyebrows, but they went to a full-cover front page that, as its lead story, was not Beirut or what have you, but was an opinion poll on what people think of astrology in the White House. If that happened at the New York Times, there would be books written about it, I promise you. And that's what happened at CBS. ABC never was the standard in broadcast journalism. CBS was.
Is the CBS news as show business factor leveling out a little bit? For instance, the entertainment-oriented morning news show that Meredith Hartley co-hosted is off the air.
Yes,
and there's a new show that's now very, very similar to, to the Today Show.
In fact, if anything, it's probably more news-oriented than the other two on the other networks. Yes, I think, because the people inside the place are still journalists. They are not very good at entertainment. They're just not nearly as good at entertainment as they are at journalism, which is why, by the way, West 57th and 48 Hours aren't nearly as successful as A, entertainment programs, and B, serious news programs. News folks, not surprisingly, tend to be best at doing news. But the other part of this, I mean, I think in a strange way what's interesting is the effect it had on these people. These are interesting people, and what they went through was kind of almost a professional genocide in a strange way. I mean, it was the invalidation of something that they believed in, and something not only that, but something that they were. And what has happened in the last 10 years to them, maybe they may not be able to recover from. Well, the ones who are out of work certainly won't recover.
My guest is television critic Peter J. Boyer. He writes for the New York Times. He's also the author of the new book, Who Killed CBS? And we'll talk more about network news after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
New York Times television correspondent Peter J. Boyer is my guest, author of Who Killed CBS? We're talking about some of the kind of programming crises that affected CBS News. Let's look at some of the economic crises. There were a couple of really big corporate takeover attempts, one that was waged by the group Fairness in Media, which was an arch-conservative group that would have been an ideological takeover of CBS, and the other was waged by Ted Turner of cable television.
Well, I mean, those are good examples of my contention is that CBS News defined the company, was its soul, its heart, gave it its worth. It tells you something that the reason CBS ultimately came into play on Wall Street and ultimately was taken over in a sort of a backdoor takeover by Lawrence Tisch, the reason it was vulnerable was because of CBS News. I mean, in a way, it was dramatically perfect that it would be CBS News that opened the door to assaults from the outside. It was because, simply, a group, a couple of lawyers and a political advisor of Jesse Helms in North Carolina believed that Dan Rather manifested a liberal bias, that they began their takeover attempt. You remember the conservatives, a million conservatives were going to buy one share of stock each and then they were going to own it. Ted Turner, that sort of jangled the ball bearings on the vehicle, and Ted Turner got involved then, and Ivan Boesky for a time got involved, and CBS sort of overreacted under Tom Wyman's leadership and did an incredibly expensive buyback plan to make the place less attractive, among other things, and harder to take over. And in the meantime, as a white knight, in steps Lawrence Tisch, who basically buys CBS for $127 a share after the board had turned down a $160 share offer from Marvin Davis. And the great irony of that is, of course, it is you could make the contention and wouldn't find a lot of argument that CBS News anyway, and perhaps the whole company, would be much better off today had Ted Turner taken them over. A, the stockholders would have gotten more money than $127 a share, and B, CBS News, instead of having less news, would have another whole news network, would have CNN. It is a sort of bad, sad, and bitter irony for CBS as things turned out. Of course, because Larry Tisch's first act, basically his first dramatic act, was the gutting of CBS News.
Do you think that television networks are still vulnerable to this type of unfriendly takeover?
I think in a way it doesn't matter so much anymore.
Why
now.
Not?
Let's say that CBS were sold tomorrow to a malevolent company.
Mm-hmm.
What could they do that would make the place less valuable as an institution, as a public trust? What would they do? Do away with documentaries? Sorry, that's been done. Fire 1 out of 10 people? Sorry, that's been done. Have the place fall into third place in the ratings? Sorry, that's where they are now. I mean, strip the company of its other businesses, such as publishing, songs, records. Sorry, that's been done in the last year and a half. Unless they like turn it over to the mob, I can't imagine. I don't think, in other words, that there is that much left to lose. I do think, by the way, that they are subject to further sale. I think there are probably a lot of people who would like to buy CBS. I think somebody probably will, and I think Larry Tisch will make a lot of money off of it.
Do you think that what happened at CBS is just a case study of what's happening in a lot of corporations around the country in different types of operations?
Yes.
What I'm thinking here is that CBS was always under the leadership of William Paley. Is he retired now officially? What's his status?
He's chairman now, but he's 86 years old.
But he doesn't have the control that he used to.
No.
And since he lost that control, there's been a series of other managers coming in and really trying to like make their vision of what the corporation should be with a lot of changes. And
that's
this
right.
kind of thing happens at corporations all over the country where traditions that have been established are overturned very quickly by someone who wants to make their mark.
That's right.
Or has a better idea for making a quick profit.
There are few institutions, however, that are so idiosyncratic that the way it was always done may be, in fact, the only way it can be done and still have what the thing you had. In a way, it's sort of broadcasting's huge version of the fact that there's no more mom and pop grocery stores on your corner, and that they all now belong to A&P or whomever. I mean, in a way, it's the version of that.
If CBS News isn't what it used to be, how is it different for us as viewers? What do you think we're missing now?
Here's how it's different. Instead of Harvest of Shame, instead of the selling of the Pentagon, instead of Defense of the United States, and instead of these broadcasts, what you now have is 48 Hours is a perfect example. 48 Hours is supposedly the documentary face of CBS News these days. It's a weekly series anchored by Dan Rather. Quick into a story, quick out of a story, 48 Hours on whatever street, and it changes. They discovered very early on, after going to the Gaza, perfect subject matter, after doing 48 hours on the campaign, perfect subject matter, that news, hard news stories, didn't get quite the ratings that they got when they did 48 hours on Runaway Street, which showed teenage prostitutes in Hollywood, or 48 hours with televangelism. And as a result, there is now a standing mandate that 48 hours will not consider what most of us consider serious news subjects, which is why last week you had 48 hours at the Westminster Dog Show. I'm telling you, that is the current CBS News documentary. That makes a difference to viewers. If you're getting 48 hours at the Westminster Dog Show and the producers, the journalists of CBS News are being told you can't go do Noriega in 48 hours in Panama, that might be an interesting story, wouldn't it, to see CBS News correspondents down there doing that? They can't do it. Why? It's too newsy for CBS News. That means something to viewers.
Do you think that the glory days of the TV networks are over?
Yes. Sadly, in a strange way. I think they are over. I still don't see anything on the horizon that will have quite the weight and influence and resources that the networks have and will continue to have for some time. But I think it's clearly gone the day that they are the three voices and basically nothing else exists out there. That is finished, and I think it's also gone the day that they have the commitment to public affairs and news that they once had. I mean, I think probably in the horizon, sooner rather than later, we will begin to see independent news-based production companies providing ersatz documentaries for the networks.
My guest is Peter J. Boyer, author of the new book, Who Killed CBS? He also writes for the New York Times. Now, you formerly were a correspondent on CBS Morning
Yes.
News.
Yeah.
So I could see how writing this book would have been a little bit tricky because these are your old bosses in a way that you were writing
Yes.
about. Did you have any second thoughts about whether you could be objective enough?
Happily,
usually
I was
people who work someplace have an axe to grind somewhere along the
yes,
line.
Yes, so happily I was there under... Given the circumstances, the broad circumstances, I was there under relatively pleasant circumstances. I had a nice, safe contract anyway there,
mm-hmm.
and I left voluntarily because I wanted to go work at the New York Times. And again, happily, I was just a reporter there. I wasn't a player really, and I was there just about a year. So that this book is a piece of reporting, not in any way a reflection of my time there.
Was it odd for you when you were doing television after having written about it?
Oh, was it strange. It was. I think it was strange for two reasons. One, I mean, some of us are just born to be in broadcasting, and some of us are just more inclined to mess around with words and a typewriter and never have to say things publicly. And on that level, it was odd. It was also odd, yes, in fact, to walk through the hallways and have people know you from your stories. And, you know, you've written about them. Maybe you've said good things. Maybe you've said bad things. And now suddenly you're working alongside them. There was a strangeness there at first, but, you know, I got over that.
What about seeing yourself on television and having to ask yourself, am I good TV or bad TV?
I never had to ask that because I was convinced from the first moment that I was terrible TV. That my wife, of course, and my mother, and even those at CBS News were nice enough to say that, in fact, I wasn't. But I didn't like the process of going on television and sort of making show. It wasn't... I would write a script and think, I'm finished. I've written what a nice little script I've written. And, of course, in television, that's just the beginning. Writing a script is, you know, nothing. In fact, a lot of reporters don't even write their own scripts. What counts then is going on, looking right, looking into the camera and saying it right. That part I just never particularly got used to. And happily, I was able to re-gear.
In the acknowledgments to your new book, Who Killed CBS, you thank Van Gordon Sauter and Dan Rather
yes.
for spending time with you. And I was kind of surprised that they did, especially given like the title of the book.
Me too. I was a little bit surprised.
And you really think that it's Van Gordon Sauter who is responsible in a lot of ways for the demise of CBS
right.
News.
I do.
We only have a few seconds left, I should tell you.
I was surprised that they did. I think I treated them both fairly, by the way. But that you're right, they don't come out completely positively. But I think that it occurred to them it's better to have a voice in this book than not have one. And they did give of their time generously.
Did you make them any promises of...
Absolutely none. Yeah. Absolutely none.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for
thank
talking
you.
With us.
This has been fun. Thank you.
And will you ever do a television commentary again, do you think, if you were off?
I'd like to. I really got a kick doing that in NPR. Now, radio is different from television.
Oh, radio you do, but television you wouldn't again?
Yeah. Well, you know, radio would have to worry about your tie being on straight.
Right.
Is
right.
it on straight?
Okay. Thanks for being with us. My guest has been Peter J. Boyer, and you might remember his commentaries from NPR's Morning Edition. He's with the New York Times now as the television correspondent. He's also the author of the new book, Who Killed CBS? The Undoing of America's Number One News Network. It's just been published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Do you catch every disease you read about in the papers or see on TV? When people say you're looking great, do you get angry? Coming up, Susan Bauer talks about hypochondria. She's just written a book examining the history, psychology, and sociology of this phenomenon. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Elizabeth Welch performing songs by America's most famous 100-year-old, Irving Berlin. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg takes a stand against making English our official language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. At least seven of the nation's largest banks today announced increases of a half a point in their prime lending rates. Chase Manhattan was the first to boost the prime to 9%. Many economists had predicted the increase because the cost of borrowing for banks themselves has been rising in recent weeks. But economist David Jones is among those who is surprised at the size of the increase.
There's still a debate as to whether or not the Federal Reserve tightening move was equivalent to a quarter of a percentage point or a full half a percentage point in terms of raising the cost of bank funds. There's still a degree of uncertainty over that, and therefore this increase in the prime rate was on the larger side of estimates.
Higher borrowing costs reflect a fear of higher inflation, fed by news that the economy is growing faster than expected. The news of the increase in the prime rate caused a big drop on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 37 points, closing at 1965.85. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 49 cents. Declines led advances 8-1 on trading of 176 million shares. Today, Congress sent President Reagan the omnibus trade bill that the president has vowed to veto. Mr. Reagan objects to a provision in the bill that requires companies to give workers notice before they close down. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The Democrats have decided that the plant closing issue is a great one politically for them. They claim to have seen polls showing that 85% of the people surveyed believe that letting workers know before they're going to lose their jobs is simply a matter of fairness. Democrats think this is an especially difficult issue for Vice President George Bush, who so far is not doing well with blue-collar workers who supported President Reagan, according to the public opinion polls. By standing with the president on this plant closing issue, Democrats think the vice president emphasizes his image as a politician with friends in the boardroom. And the Democrats are doing everything they can to play up that image. Today, they brought several laid-off workers to the Capitol to tell their stories of plants closing down and to call on the president to sign the trade bill. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Reagan will end what little suspense remains tonight as he endorses Vice President Bush to succeed him in the White House. Bush has had the nomination locked up for weeks, and today his sole remaining challenger announced plans to support Bush. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Former TV evangelist Pat Robertson met with Bush at the Vice President's White House office today to give Bush the news. There was little love lost between the two campaigns as Robertson defeated the Vice President in a number of early caucuses and finished ahead of Bush in Iowa. But today, all apparently was forgotten. Robertson said his meeting with Bush was very cordial, as were his words for the Vice President.
We're going to be working harmoniously and in unity together. And, of course, I am wholeheartedly endorsing the Vice President for the job of President of the United States.
Tonight, Republican unity will be complete as President Reagan delivers his endorsement of Bush at a Republican fundraising gala. It will, in the words of White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, be the warmest of political embraces. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington.
Two men and five women were indicted today by a federal grand jury, charged with acts of violence against the United States. All but one of the seven are in custody on other charges. They're accused of involvement in the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Capitol and various other government and private buildings. One of the women charged today, Marilyn Buck, was found guilty today, along with Matulu Shakur, of the 1981 robbery of a Brinks armored truck. Three people died during that robbery. Buck and Shapur were convicted on all eight counts, which included racketeering, conspiracy, armed robbery, and murder during a bank robbery. And Guatemala's defense minister said today a coup attempt at two military bases was put down today without violence. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is celebrating the 100th birthday of songwriter Irving Berlin with a review of a new recording of Berlin's songs by Elizabeth Welch. Welch is not far behind the centenarian songwriter. At the age of 80, Lloyd says she sounds as good as ever.
I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand always, always.
You're the top, Cole Porter wrote. You're a Berlin ballad. Of all our great songwriters, Irving Berlin is probably the most popular, in subject as well as in appeal. Other composers may have written more sophisticated music or more classical. Other writers may have written wittier or more emotionally complex lyrics. Yet no one has tapped the spirit of this century like Berlin. White Christmas, his most famous song, doesn't just celebrate a holiday, but captures what it felt like in 1942 for an American soldier to be away from home at the time when families usually gather together. God Bless America is more truly an American national anthem than the official one. Other songwriters may have hated to get up in the morning, but imagine anyone besides Berlin making a great song out of it, perhaps the most human song ever written about military life. In 1936, Berlin wrote with political acuity, "There may be trouble ahead." Nevertheless, he has Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, in one of their most ambitious numbers, decide to face the music and dance. Some of his songs have a naive tendency to be cute, anti-intellectual, sentimentally optimistic, or self-pitying. Songs like "You Can't Get a Man with a Gun," "A Pretty Girl is Like a Melody," or "A Man Chases a Girl Until She Catches Him" are now part of pre-feminist history. But at his best, his directness and simplicity have an irresistible charm and power. Of all the good records to be issued in honor of Berlin's birthday, my favorite is the new Irving Berlin songbook by Elizabeth Welch. Welch made her first Broadway appearance in Blackbirds of 1928, the longest-running all-Negro musical in Broadway history. 2 years later, after the opening of Cole Porter's show The New Yorkers, the producers got nervous about a white woman singing Love for Sale, a song about a prostitute, and they replaced her with Welch. In 1933, she knocked London on its ear and stayed. She appeared in musicals, radio, and films, including several with Paul Robeson. And she's still remarkable.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew?
Welch was 79 when she made this album, and her voice and diction might be the envy of singers half her age. I love her easy elegance, the playfulness of her phrasing, and the tenderness of her smoky delivery. One of the most moving songs on the Berlin album is Supper Time, which she wrote for Ethel Waters in 1933. At first, it seems a typical blues song about a woman abandoned by her man. But it's actually about a lynching, like Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. Welch's rendition keeps Ethel Waters' understatement, but adds a few heart-wrenching undercurrents of her own.
Supper time, I should set the table, 'cause it's supper time, but somehow I'm not able, 'cause that man of mine ain't coming home no more. Supper time, kids will soon be yelling for their supper time. How'll I keep from telling that that man of mine ain't coming home no more? How'll I keep explaining when they ask me where he's gone?
How'll I keep from crying when I bring their supper on? How can I remind them to pray at their humble board? How can I be thankful when they start to thank the Lord? Lord, supper time, I should set the table, 'cause it's supper time. Somehow I ain't able, 'cause that man of mine ain't coming home no more. He ain't coming home no more.
What better tribute to a composer on his living centennial than for his music to be performed with such deep understanding and affection by a singer of a younger generation like Elizabeth Welch?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Elizabeth Welch, the Irving Berlin songbook, on the Verve label.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
This is Fresh Air. Some doctors call them GOMERS. That's an acronym for Get Out of My Emergency Room. But for hypochondriacs, their illnesses are very real. Hypochondria has been with us for centuries. Susan Bauer, a psychologist and science writer, examines this phobia from all sides in her new book, Hypochondria: Woeful Imaginings. I asked her to begin with a definition.
Hypochondria is a preoccupation with health or disease, whose intensity disrupts normal living habits. That's really important. Almost anyone can be preoccupied with a symptom if it gets bad enough, but they usually just do something about it and that's the end of it. But this is a person who's so preoccupied with symptoms or with the fear of getting a disease that their normal living habits are disrupted more than they really should be, even if there is something slightly wrong with them.
You say that hypochondriacs don't play by the rules of being sick. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that really the number one rule in our culture for sick people is you're supposed to want to get better. And yet the hypochondriac seems to just have a recurring number of symptoms and problems. And at some point, the doctor, the long-suffering wife or husband, finally says, you know, it really feels as if you just don't want to get well. What's going on? It's as if their illnesses are their treasures, and yet they moan and groan just the way all of us do.
There's something called the Whitley Index, and you include that in the back of your book, and it's basically a little questionnaire, and depending on which questions you say yes to and which you say no to, it can diagnose if you're a hypochondriac, and if so, which kind. Can I go through a couple of these questions and you could tell me what they're measuring?
I can try. Let's try that.
Okay. This is one I like. If a disease is brought to your attention through radio, television, newspapers, or someone you know, do you worry about getting it yourself?
That's asking the person if they're suggestible. Which has been known for centuries, millennia,
right,
to be the hallmark of hypochondriacs.
Yes, it's sometimes hard to interview doctors about certain diseases. Okay, how about this one? If you are ill and someone tells you that you are looking better, are you annoyed?
Okay, that one is tapping the firm conviction of disease. The person who has unremitting symptoms, they know they've got a poor back, their mother had it, their grandmother had it, and anyone who thinks that they look better is the enemy, because what they really mean is, why don't you do your housework or whatever.
And finally, are you afraid of illness? That's an interesting question. I mean, who isn't? But I guess this is a matter of degree, huh? How afraid you are.
Yeah, it really is. Also, I think maybe the question might have been clearer. Are you afraid of illnesses you don't have?
Right. Your book is in part a historical survey of hypochondria. And it's really interesting how the symptoms of hypochondria have changed over the centuries. For instance, no one takes liver pills anymore.
True, definitely.
What are some of the ways historically that hypochondriacs express their symptoms?
Well, I think what you'll see throughout is that the diseases that hypochondriacs are particularly afraid of and thus prone to are diseases for which there is no cure and for which there is, in their culture, a tinge of sort of shame or guilt about them. For example, in the 19th century, syphilis, which was quite a serious disease and there was no really effective cure, was greatly feared. Today, cancer is number one on the disease hit parade, heart problems second, and AIDS is, I don't think anyone really knows. You can't say quite where it comes, but it's just a perfect candidate for all sorts of fears.
It's a very scary thing because many people have rightful fears of having contacted it. So it becomes the kind of thing where it's impossible to draw the line between monitoring your symptoms and being, you know, absurdly fixated on something.
Except that, again, it's that preoccupation, does it or does it not disrupt normal living habits, and is it disproportionate to the risk? So if a person has been living with perhaps a succession of persons who are using intravenous drugs, that person has a very reasonable fear of AIDS and should be tested or do whatever he or she thinks is necessary to protect themselves and the others that they love. However, if a person has had a one-night stand with a farm girl in Iowa 9 years ago, that person should not be preoccupied to the point of disrupting his daily living.
There are many theories, medical, psychological, sociological, about why certain people become hypochondriacs. Are there any current theories that you find of special interest?
I guess one that I think is particularly interesting is that there is an attempt to test empirically a very old belief about hypochondria, namely that hypochondriacs come into the world more sensitive, more jumpy, if you will, than regular people. And experimenters are beginning to find that, indeed, hypochondriacs can register tinier stimuli, the merest flash of light, the drop of a pin, and are just a more reactive organism than people who never become hypochondriacal. That's what people from Shakespeare for the next two centuries said. Oh, I'm so delicate.
Why are you so interested in the subject that you've written a whole book about it?
Well, there were two reasons, one personal and one intellectual. The personal one was that during college, I wildly overreacted to physical symptoms. And although I didn't bother doctors with them, I sweated bullets. I had the nightmares. In college, my throat used to start to close up, and boy, I was sure death was around the corner. So I have those memories. Intellectually, I wanted to write in the history of medicine, but I really wanted to pick a topic where I had to consider the biology, the physiology, I had to consider the psychology and the sociology of the subjects, the sufferers. And there is no disease, I maintain, that is as perfect for forcing you to be interdisciplinary than hypochondria. It's an emotional problem. They take them to physical, you know, to medical doctors complaining of physical symptoms. And the sociology is important.
Do you think that most of us have hypochondria to one degree or another? For instance, I'm the kind of patient who, when I'm going to see a doctor, I just assume not find out the worst thing that can happen to me if my disease progresses, or the worst side effect I can get from the medicine I'm taking, because I'm sure that it'll happen, you know, or that I'll wake up in the middle of the night imagining that that symptom is beginning.
Yeah, I would guess then that you're a person who is aware of your penchant for, or at least ability to exaggerate, to think the worst, and you're coping by saying, look, give me the amount of information I need to know today, and if I need more later, I'll face that then. I think almost everyone either knows somebody who's hypochondriacal or has experienced enough, at least by the time they're in their mid-20s or 30s, to know what I'm talking about when I talk about hypochondria. But no, not everyone is hypochondriacal.
Did writing this book wreak havoc on your sense of being prone to certain symptoms?
No, quite the reverse.
Uh-huh.
As Otto Fenichel would say, belated mastery. It was something I really wanted to do. And it's interesting that when I started the book, it took about 4 years, not working full-time, but I really had to educate myself in a lot of ways. When I started the book, I would read things about hypochondriacs and ask myself if they pertain to me. And the majority, I would say, absolutely not. Oh, you know, really quite annoyed by some people. By the time I was finished the book, I was nodding and saying, yes, yes, profound, right. I really learned quite a bit about myself in doing the book.
Susan Bauer is the author of Hypochondria, Woeful Imaginings, published by the University of California Press. She spoke to us from WGBH in Boston. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what they have planned. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, a lot of news about the trade bill, about how President François Mitterrand pulled off another election in France, about how Pat Robertson wrapped up his campaign here in the United States. Also, some really interesting features tonight. Did you know that the balloons, helium balloons, are now causing environmental damage?
No kidding. What kind?
Well, you'll have to listen in to find out how.
Okay.
And did you know that Irving Berlin is 100 years old today?
How are you celebrating the birthday?
Well, can you think of any of his hit songs?
Sure.
Like what?
White Christmas, Cheek to Cheek.
Well, tune in. You might hear Blue Skies and more tonight on All Things Considered.
Okay, those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The federal amnesty program, which ended last week, allowed thousands of illegal aliens the opportunity to apply for permanent residency. Congress has been dealing with a related issue. Should English be the official language of America? Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says no.
As I was reading about all those aliens lining up to get in under the amnesty program, I couldn't help recalling a scene from a very curious 1941 movie called Hold Back the Dawn. Charles Boyer plays a world-weary Romanian refugee who's living in a Tijuana boarding house while he's conniving to get into the United States. To this end, he woos an American schoolteacher he meets, played by Olivia de Havilland. At one point, the innocent de Havilland is trying to explain America to Boyer. She says something like, "Don't you see, George, America's like a big lake. Streams flow in from all over and their waters mix together." Boyer says to her cynically, "You Americans build rather high walls around your lake." And de Havilland answers in this sweet schoolteacher voice, "Only to keep out the scum, George." Our attitudes toward immigrants have always been somewhat contradictory. We want to welcome them to a place at our table, but we keep casting nervous eyes at the silver. In the last couple of weeks, the conflicting strains have emerged in two contradictory congressional actions dealing with language policy. 2 weeks ago, the House passed an omnibus education bill that authorize extensive English language instruction programs for both kids and adults, and bilingual education programs to ease their transition into American society. You can get an idea of how sorely this bill was needed from the fact that the year before the recent amnesty was declared, there were 60,000 people turned away from English language classes in Los Angeles County alone. The new authorization won't satisfy the clamor for English language instruction, particularly now that 2 million more immigrants have been allowed to come out of hiding, but it's certainly an important step. But there's another story in the news that betrays the more suspicious side of our nature. The House Judiciary Committee has just opened hearings on the proposed English language amendment to the Constitution, which would declare English the official language of the United States and would effectively bar the government from providing services in any other language. The thinking behind these proposals is that we have to take steps to coerce immigrants into learning English. If we allow them to apply for driver's license tests or employment information in Spanish or Vietnamese, the logic goes, they'll be content to fester forever in the foreign language enclaves of South Florida or East L.A. These sentiments are unworthy of us and something of an insult to those 60,000 people waiting to get into English courses in L.A., not to mention our own immigrant ancestors, who are often regarded with the same mistrust. The constitutional amendment is pointless and wholly unnecessary. With or without it, the new immigrants will learn English and will enter the American mainstream just as our ancestors did. There's only one problem. If the new immigrant groups run true to form, their children and grandchildren will speak only English. On the basis of census figures, the sociologist Calvin Weitman has estimated that if immigration were entirely cut off tomorrow, American Spanish-speaking communities would completely disappear within 2 generations, just like the German and Swedish and Italian-speaking communities of the earlier part of the century. Unless someone intervenes, the descendants of the recent Hispanic, Haitian, and Vietnamese immigrants will wind up as true monolingual Americans, just like all those kids named Becker and D'Angelo who were struggling their way through German 1 and Italian 1 in their sophomore year of high school. Instead of a constitutional amendment to compel people to learn English, maybe we should think about declaring that our official national languages will henceforth be Latin and Greek, and French, and German, and Japanese, and Yiddish.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the history of the Yiddish theater in America. Lella Rosenfeld will join us. Her grandfather, Jacob Adler, was the Yiddish theater's greatest star around the turn of the century. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Shoes Best, a collection of tunes from Shoes, an eccentric band from Zion, Illinois, that refuses to tour, rarely deals with the media, and still insists they can make it big. And guest film critic Michael Schrago will review High Tide, an Australian film starring Judy Davis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.